Among techies, 2011 is being dubbed the year of the patent wars. Major players like Apple, Google, and Microsoft are spending billions of dollars buying thousands of patents. Most recently, Google spent $12.5 billion to buy a cell phone company and its 17,000 patents. To learn more, we reached NPR's Laura Seidel, who's been reporting on the patent wars. Good morning.
Good morning.
Laura, start by giving us an example of a single battle, one patent that's being fought over.
Okay, well, let's take Apple suing the company HTC, which is a Taiwanese cell phone maker that makes Android cell phones, uses the Android operating system. So Apple is suing HTC and has won the first round, though it's going to be appealed. But here's what the patent is for. You know, when you get an email on your cell phone and you see, say, a phone number or a link to something and it's underlined and you press it and it goes to a map or it says, do you want to call that phone number? Apple
Right.
says, we have a patent on that. They say that Android phones, which in fact do the same thing, are violating their patent. You should understand, though, and this is what gets so weird about these patent wars, is that this is a patent from 1995.
And
there were barely any cell phones. There certainly weren't smartphones, but there were barely cell phones in 1995. So a lot of people say what's really going on is this is about trying to stop your competitor from competing with you. You grab this big, broad patent and you use it to sue your competitor.
So that is basically what these companies have to gain. A leg up.
Now, what happens is that, say, a company like Google, which, of course, created the Android system, didn't have a lot of patents. That is one of the major reasons they are buying a company called Motorola Mobility, which makes cell phones, but also has a portfolio of some 17,000 patents and then another few thousand patent applications in the works. Google probably hasn't a clue what is really in that big trove of patents, but they figure there must be something in there that's probably overly broad and that they can use to try and sue, say, Apple back. It's kind of like the Cold War, right? It says, you know, well, I've got this in my stockpile. And they say, all right, let's have a cross-licensing agreement. And then they stop the lawsuits. I should say, Renee, that a lot of people think this is a terrible waste.
A terrible waste of energy, money, whatnot. I mean, I'm looking
Everything.
At a graphic. I'm looking at a graphic of the patent suits, and it's like a plate of spaghetti. Every
yeah.
arrow is going in all directions. All the big companies seem to be involved.
Yes. I mean, all right, so look. So Google spends $12.5 billion, right, to buy this company. That's $12.5 billion that basically didn't go into making new products. It didn't go into hiring anybody. And it will probably show its head maybe when you go to buy the Android phone. And the price goes up.
Right. So it does affect consumers.
It does affect more than just these big companies. So you as a consumer, first off, may pay more. Secondly, it may slow down innovation. There are a variety of ways in which this is also being used to stop the next cool thing from happening, because you can just try and sue not only a big company, but maybe a small company that's coming in to compete in your market with some new cool idea. And yes, so this will affect you and me.
Is there some way for a peace treaty to be signed in these patent wars?
I don't think so. From my understanding, Google didn't have many patents because they really didn't actually want to play in this war. But I think that any big company now really has no choice, because you come along and you essentially will end up getting sued. So I think what we are likely to see in the next few years is even more of this, a lot more buying up of patent portfolios. So, for example, you may see some people try to bid on Kodak, which has a huge valuable patent portfolio. Some say that Kodak's patent portfolio is even more valuable than Kodak itself. And I think this is going to be going on for a while.
Laura, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Laura Seidel is NPR's digital culture correspondent, and you can hear more of her reporting on the players in the patent wars, including one group of people called patent trolls, on npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green. There is a lot of speculation today about the future of Apple. Yesterday, CEO Steve Jobs resigned. Jobs has been struggling with a rare form of pancreatic cancer. It's hard to think of another person who's shaped our relationship with technology more completely than Steve Jobs. Even if you don't have an Apple product, the computer or phone that you do have is likely to have been designed in response to the Macintosh or perhaps the iPhone. And it has been Steve Jobs personally who's introduced Apple's new products.
Today, I'm incredibly pleased to introduce iMac.
iPod is an MP3 music player.
iPhone.
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
And we call it the iPad.
Joining us to talk now about Steve Jobs' departure and what it might mean for Apple is NPR's Laura Seidel. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
So Jobs offers his resignation in a letter. Tell us what he had to say.
It was actually a very sad letter. Jobs wrote that he always said that if there came a day when he could no longer meet his duties and the expectations as Apple's CEO, he said, I would be the first to let you know. And he went on and said, unfortunately, that day has come. Some of my sources inside Apple say they weren't surprised when the announcement came because even though he has been out on sick leave, at other times he would show up, he'd be around. He hasn't been around at all, apparently, in recent weeks. Folks there have been pretty much told to carry on and not speculate too much. In his letter, he advised the board to make Tim Cook the new CEO, and they have followed his advice.
And what do we know about Tim Cook?
Well, he's been at the company over 12 years, and he became the chief operating officer back in 2004. In recent years, Jobs has taken several medical leaves to deal with the pancreatic cancer, and Cook has run the company. And in 2009, under Cook's leadership, when Jobs was out, the company did incredibly well. It had two stellar quarters. So he's done a good job when Jobs hasn't been there. He's a logistics guy. So Cook is the one who's done things like develop a more efficient supply chain for Apple products. He's known to be a very calm guy, which is actually really good, I'm told, for working with Steve Jobs, who actually is a very temperamental personality.
Well, you say Steve Jobs hasn't been seen around the company recently, but he really has been the face of Apple. I mean, everyone knows his black turtleneck and the blue jeans when we see the announcements on television. And personality is so important in business. I mean, can Tim Cook really fill those shoes?
You know, the truth is, I don't know that anybody can fill Steve Jobs' shoes. Steve Jobs may be one of the greatest CEOs to have ever lived. I mean, he's just, he's amazing. He's charismatic. He's done incredible things. He took Apple from the brink of bankruptcy and brought it back and has turned it into one of the most valuable companies in the world. But here's the thing about Tim Cook. He's actually part of a handpicked team that Steve Jobs has developed himself. So it's not him alone. It's Johnny Ive, who's head of the design team and is responsible for many of these beautiful designs that we see on Apple products. Phil Schiller, who heads marketing. And apparently Schiller is the one who was down yesterday talking to everybody and read Steve Jobs' letter to the staff there. And right now, Apple's got a line of products going through 2015. So they're set up, and hopefully this team will be able to carry through. And remember, Steve isn't exactly leaving. He's no longer the CEO. He will be chair of the board. Mm. So chances are he'll still be involved. Apparently, he talks to Tim Cook every day, and we'll see how that goes. He's traditionally been a very hands-on CEO. This is going to be a very different kind of role for him. But fill his shoes? I don't know that anybody can do that.
Well, and we should say that Apple's not just a gadget company. I mean, we all know they run iTunes, which is the biggest music retailer in the country. You say there are long-term plans already in place that Steve Jobs has laid out, but can a program like that really run on autopilot?
Well, you know, he was back in June. He actually made an announcement that there would be a new, what would be called cloud storage for iTunes. What this means is essentially you'll be able to store your music and your movies online and access them from anywhere. So yes, there seems to be a plan moving forward. But here's the thing about Steve Jobs. This is the guy who took all of the record companies who were afraid of the digital space. He got them all together and got them to join up on iTunes. And he's probably been working as well with some of the film companies and the other content providers. As we move forward in this space, as more and more people go to the web, go online for their movies, their film, their music, it's getting more and more competitive. So down the line, if we don't have a Steve Jobs to go and to talk to the content providers, someone who has his charisma, it's hard to say where all that's going to go. It's going to be a very rapidly changing universe, and whether there's someone inside Apple who can navigate those waters, I don't know.
Laura, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's NPR's Laura Seidel in San Francisco.
It's hard to think of the company Apple without thinking of its co-founder, Steve Jobs. Yesterday, Jobs, a force who has reshaped the world of technology, turned in his letter of resignation. He's stepping down as CEO. Steve Jobs has been battling a rare form of pancreatic cancer, and his departure has been expected for a while. To talk more about what's next for Apple and Jobs, we called Stephen Levy. He's written two books on Apple and is a senior writer at Wired Magazine. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, let's start with the billion-dollar question. Can Apple continue to create the kind of products it's known for without its visionary leader?
Well, in a sense, its leader hasn't been there day-to-day. He's been on medical leave since the beginning of the year. That's not his first medical leave. And the company became, at one point, the most valuable company on Earth. So in the short term, maybe even in the medium term, Apple has proved that it can get by without him, doing his day-to-day work, looking over every single shoulder.
It was certainly proved it in recent years, but he's more or less there. Back in the 80s, when he was pushed out of Apple, he returned a decade later, and the company was in tatters. Over the long run in the future, is there fear that losing Jobs could lead to a decline?
Well, I think the question really is not so much a slow decline, but an inability to come up with the next big thing, which is Apple has really done with astounding success since Steve returned to the company in 1997. The way that he's been able to do is always identify the next revolution and make it happen. And so that would be the question, really, whether Steve would be not able to work closely enough to say, oh, here's how we're going to take over the living room and be, even an absentee general, but a general in that campaign.
And, of course, who's there to do that for him, if anyone?
Well, Apple has a succession plan, which it just executed. Tim Cook is now the CEO. He's more of an operations guy. And Apple does have what's known as a deep bench. There's a lot of talent there. But one would expect that Apple would keep importing new people and maybe, some people with the kind of vision that Steve is known for. He's sort of shown the way. You don't have to reinvent Steve Jobs to come up with an amazing product, though there is no other Steve Jobs.
Of course, he's not leaving entirely. He'll stay on at Apple as the chairman of the board, which allows him, how much of a hand in the company's direction?
Well, if he's up to it, I think it's going to be something unusual. It would be something like what we've seen during this medical leave, where he was not involved in day-to-day operations, but he could parachute in and even launch a product. I don't know if he'll do that, his famous keynotes, but he'll do strategy. He'll come up with ideas for new products. He'll even negotiate with other executives when he's dealing with content companies to work with and partner with products and things like that. So if he's up to it, I don't think Tim Cook is going to say to Steve Jobs, I don't want to hear your ideas, or I don't want you to be a big part of coming up with our next big product.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Stephen Levy is a senior writer at Wired. His most recent of two books on Apple is called The Perfect Thing. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green. There is a lot of speculation today about the future of Apple. Yesterday, CEO Steve Jobs resigned. Jobs has been struggling with a rare form of pancreatic cancer. It's hard to think of another person who's shaped our relationship with technology more completely than Steve Jobs. Even if you don't have an Apple product, the computer or phone that you do have is likely to have been designed in response to the Macintosh or perhaps the iPhone. And it has been Steve Jobs personally who's introduced Apple's new products.
Today, I'm incredibly pleased to introduce iMac.
iPod is an MP3 music player. iPhone. Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
And we call it the iPad.
Joining us to talk now about Steve Jobs' departure and what it might mean for Apple is NPR's Laura Seidel. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
So Jobs offers his resignation in a letter. Tell us what he had to say.
It was actually a very sad letter. Jobs wrote that he always said that if there came a day when he could no longer meet his duties and the expectations as Apple CEO, he said, "I would be the first to let you know." And he went on and said, "Unfortunately, that day has come." Some of my sources inside Apple say they weren't surprised when the announcement came because even though he has been out on sick leave, at other times he would show up, he'd be around. He hasn't been around at all, apparently, in recent weeks. Folks there have been pretty much told to carry on and not speculate too much. In his letter, he advised the board to make Tim Cook the new CEO, and they have followed his advice.
And what do we know about Tim Cook?
Well, he's been at the company over 12 years, and he became the chief operating officer back in 2004. In recent years, Jobs has taken several medical leaves to deal with the pancreatic cancer, and Cook has run the company. And in 2009, under Cook's leadership, when Jobs was out, the company did incredibly well. It had two stellar quarters. So he's done a good job when Jobs hasn't been there. He's a logistics guy. So Cook is the one who's done things like develop a more efficient supply chain for Apple products. He's known to be a very calm guy, which is actually really good, I'm told, for working with Steve Jobs, who actually is a very temperamental personality.
Well, you say Steve Jobs hasn't been seen around the company recently, but he really has been the face of Apple. I mean, everyone knows his black turtleneck and the blue jeans when we see the announcements on television. And personality is so important in business. I mean, can Tim Cook really fill those shoes?
You know, the truth is, I don't know that anybody can fill Steve Jobs' shoes. Steve Jobs may be one of the greatest CEOs to have ever lived. I mean, he's just, he's amazing. He's charismatic. He's done incredible things. He took Apple from the brink of bankruptcy and brought it back and has turned it into one of the most valuable companies in the world. But here's the thing about Tim Cook. He's actually part of a handpicked team that Steve Jobs has developed himself. So it's not him alone. It's Johnny Ive, who's head of the design team and is responsible for many of these beautiful designs that we see on Apple products. Phil Schiller, who heads marketing. And apparently Schiller is the one who was down yesterday talking to everybody and read Steve Jobs' letter to the staff there. And right now, Apple's got a line of products going through 2015. So they're set up, and hopefully this team will be able to carry through. And remember, Steve isn't exactly leaving. He's no longer the CEO. He will be chair of the board. So chances are he'll still be involved. Apparently, he talks to Tim Cook every day, and we'll see how that goes. He's traditionally been a very hands-on CEO. This is going to be a very different kind of role for him. But fill his shoes? I don't know that anybody can do that.
Well, and we should say that Apple's not just a gadget company. I mean, we all know they run iTunes, which is the biggest music retailer in the country. You say there are long-term plans already in place that Steve Jobs has laid out, but can a program like that really run on autopilot?
Well, you know, he was back in June. He actually made an announcement that there would be a new what would be called cloud storage for iTunes. What this means is essentially you'll be able to store your music and your movies online and access them from anywhere. So yes, there seems to be a plan moving forward. But here's the thing about Steve Jobs. This is the guy who took all of the record companies who were afraid of the digital space. He got them all together and got them to join up on iTunes. And he's probably been working as well with some of the film companies and the other content providers. As we move forward in this space, as more and more people go to the web, go online for their movies, their film, their music, it's getting more and more competitive. So down the line, if we don't have a Steve Jobs to go and to talk to the content providers, someone who has his charisma, it's hard to say where all that's going to go. It's going to be a very rapidly changing universe. And whether there's someone inside Apple who can navigate those waters, I don't know.
Laura, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's NPR's Laura Seidel in San Francisco.
The resignation of Steve Jobs as CEO of Apple has prompted a lot of retrospectives on the man who's run the iconic company for the last 14 years. Jobs will take on a more limited role as chairman. But as NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, Apple's future now depends on how well it can manage without the day-to-day guidance of the man who created the company.
Most companies, if they're lucky, have one great idea. What's made Apple different, the thing that sets it apart from other technology companies, is its ability to stage wildly successful second, third, and fourth acts. Michael Gartenberg is a director at the research firm Gartner. He thinks Apple is well positioned to carry on.
At the end of the day, there's much more to Apple than just one person, even if that person is Steve Jobs.
Gartenberg says Apple's biggest asset is its culture and its other longtime employees. Skeptics of the past doubted the company could succeed in retail or in music or in the phone business. It managed to master each one and in the process transform those industries.
Perhaps Apple's greatest success has been their ability to not rest on their laurels, to not be satisfied with the status quo, but to continue to drive innovation forward.
But to anyone who suggests that Apple without Steve Jobs is still the same Apple, Trip Chowdhury says you must be crazy.
Apple is Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs is innovation. Innovation is Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs is Apple. That's the equation.
Chowdhury is an analyst with Global Equities Research. He says history proves Apple isn't successful without Jobs. The company faltered after Jobs was forced out in 1985, then flourished when he returned. Chowdhury says Apple clearly has some talented people, but in the past, they've needed a visionary to succeed. He cites a list of firms, including Palm, that were started by ex-Apple executives that eventually flopped.
If that is not convincing, Apple's co-founder Steve Wozniak, what has he accomplished when he left Apple? The answer is very clear, nothing.
He says this time, Jobs is leaving Apple with a detailed roadmap that Chowdhury estimates may help guide the company for another 3 years. And he compares what's left of Apple without Jobs to a bunch of pre-programmed robots carrying out those orders.
The only thing is they are pre-programmed for the next 3 years. After that, what happens, you know, we don't know.
Rob Enderle is a longtime Silicon Valley watcher who runs his own research firm. He says it's not just that Jobs had the ability to see huge opportunities in the market that no one else saw. He was also an incredibly feared micromanager. Enderle says Jobs made final calls on things like whether a device should lose a standard feature in order to have a thinner design. And if something wasn't to his liking, he was swift and harsh in his critiques, which Enderle says could verge on cruel.
It's not uncommon to find people in Apple that have been fired multiple times by Jobs personally.
Jobs would upbraid or threaten suppliers whose products were late or defective.
He was kind of the hitman inside Apple who you didn't want to talk to if you were either an employee or a supplier.
Yet people wanted to work there, Enderle says, because the flip side of that was that Jobs possessed an uncanny ability to see the future and channel that to the masses.
And you often see that in political leaders or religious leaders that try to pass the torch, that intangible something that made you sit down and hang on every word is unique to them.
And that's why Enderle says it's hard to say what lies ahead for Apple. He says Microsoft, Intel, and IBM all lost something special when they lost their charismatic leaders. He says they're all doing fine now. They're just not as magical as they once were. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Online, a good review can make a hotel trendy, and a bad one can put a plumber out of a job. It's no wonder that a few businesses are trying to fake us out. And it can be tough for a human to tell a real review from one dreamed up by someone paid to write it. But Jeff Hancock says he's got a computer program that can. He's a researcher at Cornell University who studies deception, and his team came up with software to unmask fake online reviews.
It gets at the very basic idea of what these reviews are about, trust. And as long as there's not so many deceptive reviews, we can continue to use them. But once deception gets too high, it becomes an unusable system.
So to develop the software that you did, you essentially trained it on a pool of truthful reviews from online and fake reviews written for the study. And then it went head-to-head against human judges. How did the humans do?
The humans didn't do very well, and this is consistent with about 40 years of psychological research on deception detection. Our humans got, at best, up to around 60% trying to decide between the two. The computer, on the other hand, could get up to 90% accuracy.
Why are we so bad at figuring out when people are lying to us?
Because we've been lying for as long as we've been talking. And that's about 60,000 years, so we have lots of practice.
So you've brought along a couple of the hotel reviews you used in the research, the same ones, one fake and one authentic.
That's right.
Can we hear those? And let's see if we can figure it out.
My husband and I stayed at the James Chicago Hotel for our anniversary. This place is fantastic. We knew as soon as we arrived that we made the right choice. The area of the hotel is great. Since I love to shop, I couldn't ask for more. We will definitely be back to Chicago, and we will for sure be back to the James Chicago.
Okay, so let's hear the second one.
I've stayed at many hotels, traveling for both business and pleasure, and I can honestly say that the James is tops. The location is perfect, within walking distance to all the great sites and restaurants. Highly recommend to both business travelers and couples.
Oh, wow. The first one kind of bugs me because it keeps using the name of the hotel, which, you know, I don't know if most people would do that. But the second one sounds like such an ad. I mean, there was something about it that just sounds so phony.
So you're going to go with the second one as fake?
You know, I don't know. I'm going to go with the first.
You're correct.
Really? You're kidding.
You did it.
Now, was it about both of those?
Well, I'll give you one reason. There's a kind of word called a function word. That's the thes and ahs, the prepositions, the pronouns, all the little words. We as humans, we completely ignore those. We don't pay attention to them. We don't think about them when we're producing them.
Really?
And that's one of the things. Yeah, that's one of the things we found in this study is that the fake review writers overused first-person reference. And you can hear in that ad that there's, or in that review, that there are quite a few references to herself in there. My family, I love shopping, it's perfect for me, I will be back.
So the second one talked generally, but he didn't mention himself.
Yeah.
That's often...
He didn't mention himself as much, but what he did do is something quite different. And one of the things that is difficult for liars to do is to produce spatial information. You heard in that review he was talking about location to shopping, those sort of things.
You've done a lot of research about deception on the internet. Do people lie differently online than they have historically offline to each other?
I don't think psychologically lying has changed that much. So we see that in online dating, for example, people will lie about their height and weight. Mm. And this is not new to the internet. Men and women have been lying about those sort of things for millennia. What's new, though, is in the past, I would fake my height or weight through, say, clothing. Now, online, it's much more of a tell-me world rather than a show-me world.
Jeff Hancock is an associate professor of communication at Cornell University. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Laura. It was a pleasure.